Thanks very much. Is it or, okay? It's very nice to be here again. I'll tell you about some properties based on some work in progress with Alba Grassi and Luigi Tizzano from the Simon Center of the simplest non-trivial correlation functions in four dimensions. And I will probably also review very quickly necessary results by from previous collaborations and also many other papers that I didn't mention, but I'll mention some in the course of this talk. So the simplest non-trivial, so there is a system, a supersymmetric system, which leads to non-trivial correlation functions in four dimensions. And it's a very fun toy model for the bootstrap, which we have already studied in the past. But now it has, as you see, a new life with new physics and some new aspects that were previously not known. So let me define the system. So we're talking about the four-dimensional quantum field theory. Concretely, in this talk, I will I'll focus my attention on SU2 gauge theory with n equals 2 supersymmetry and four hypermultiplets. This is a conformal field theory, which has an exactly marginal parameter, an exactly marginal coupling, Jiang-Mills. Okay. So for those who are not experts in supersymmetry, the details are not important. The most important thing is that there is a conformal manifold, and there is an exactly marginal coupling, Jiang-Mills, which intuitively is the same as the Jiang-Mills coupling that you know from ordinary gauge theories. There is also a theta angle, but it would not be important for this talk. I will maybe make some comments at the end. So there is a Jiang-Mills coupling, and there is a set of correlation functions which are non-trivial, but they're under a theoretical control. And these are correlation functions that involve half BPS operators. So this theory has half BPS operators, which are going to be labeled by O, and they'll have an index J, and the coordinate is going to be X. J is going to be an integer, a positive integer. O0 would be, by definition, the unit operator. And the dimension of the operator OJ is going to be 2J. So this is a system, there are such half BPS operators in the theory. And the details are not really important. I'm just going to present the main, the structure of this bootstrap problem. So there is such a space of operators. Their dimensions are integer, 2J, where J is a positive integer. And the interesting question that you might ask about this conformal field theory is about correlation functions of such operators. Now, the correlation functions of operators that involve only O and no O bars, they all trivially vanish in R4 because of a certain selection rule. These operators also carry a U1 charge. So the U1 charge of these operators OJ can be taken to be, by convention, 4J. That's the usual convention. The usual convention in the literature would be 4J. So if you have only insertions of O, then it trivially vanishes. The next thing to try are correlation functions of OJ1 at some X1 all the way to OJN at some XN, and then O bar with some J at Y. So these correlation functions don't obviously vanish if you take J to be equal to the sum of the JIs. So if J is just the sum over the JIs, then this correlation function may not vanish. And in fact, this correlation function may be a non-trivial function of the coupling constant and of the coordinates. These correlation functions are the simplest non-zero correlation functions in any four-dimensional quantum field theory, as far as I know. And they are called extremal correlation functions. Extremal because they have only one anti-BPS operator. If you had two such O bars, then the problem would be probably as difficult as computing correlation functions in any quantum filter, and it would be unwieldy. But if you just have one O bar, then it's still under some theoretical control, and we can do many things explicitly. So these are called extremal correlation functions in the literature. For some historical reasons, they're called extremal correlation functions. Now, using superconformal wired identities, it's possible to constrain the X dependence of these correlation functions. So it turns out that these correlation functions are, the X dependence is severely constrained. So there is X and Y here. The X dependence is severely constrained, and the most you can get is some function G, 2J, that's just the notation in the literature. I'll explain this notation in a second, of G and Mills. And the XY dependence is very easy. It's just 1 over XI minus Y to the power 2, so to the power 4J, JI, and you take a product. So the XY dependence is extremely simple. It's a product of 1 over XI minus Y with some powers, which are integer. And the whole non-trivial information is in the prefactor here. Now, the reason that this prefactor doesn't depend on the specific JIs, but only on J, is because of the fact that if you multiply two O's, the OP is regular. So if you take OI, OJI, OJJ, OJK at X and Y, this leads to OX at JI plus JK plus regular pieces. So by using this space-time dependence of the correlation function plus the fact that the OP is regular, you can always simplify any such correlation function to essentially a two-point function. So you can also write a formula for G to J in terms of a two-point function, unnormalized two-point function. So OJ, OJ bar, sorry, O bar J, is just G to J, G angles. And you can put this insertion at infinity, this insertion at the origin, and the XY dependence drops. So this is a slightly weird convention for a bootstrap conference. I'm just saying that you could either think about these coefficients as OP coefficients, G. You can either think about them as OP coefficients of, let's say, O1, OJ, OJ plus 1. Or you can think about them as the two-point functions. So if you chose to normalize the two-point functions canonically, they would pop out in the three-point functions. Or you can choose to normalize the OP in such a way so that the chiral ring relations are obeyed in this way, and then they pop out in the two-point functions. So you can go between these two normalizations. This is not the usual bootstrap normalization, but that's convenient for this talk. So I'll stick to this normalization. So basically, you should think about those guys as OP coefficients. These are OP coefficients. And indeed, the people who work on the numerical bootstrap measure these OP coefficients in various cases that I'll mention more. So this is the problem, to try to compute these G to Js. And it started by people computing them in perturbation theory, just ordinary Feynman diagram perturbation theory. And I have somewhere here, just to demonstrate that the answer is non-trivial, I'll show you the first example. So G2, people computed G2 in perturbation theory, and they found a piece which is just the three-level piece, so 3 over 8 Jiang-Mills squared. That was just the Jiang-Mills to the 4, sorry. That was just the three-level piece, and then they computed the next piece, and there were some zeta values. And then there was Jiang-Mills to the power 8. And then they even computed, there was even one more order that people computed with Feynman diagrams. Zeta 5 over 64 pi cubed Jiang-Mills to the power 10. So it's a non-trivial problem. The OP coefficients depend on this coupling. And even by inspection of the first few terms that people computed, you can see that the coefficients grow pretty fast. So this looks like a Dyson series with zero radius of convergence. So this already displays some of the general things that we expect in quantum field theory, that the radius of convergence of perturbation theory would be zero. And there are alternating signs, as you can see from these three terms. That's also something that people expect in the absence of renormalons. So this matches many, many expectations from infrared safe observables in QCD. So it's interesting to study this problem a little bit further, especially that there is supersymmetry and you might be able to say more about it. Okay, so this is the background. Now let me tell you about some new results in this field that motivated us to go back and study this problem. So some new results in this field from just like a few months ago. Some new observations about these correlation functions. These observations were made by two groups, Bourget and collaborators, and Beccaria in a single author paper. So what they have found is really striking. What they have found is that even though we're discussing SU2 gauge theory, there is a Hooft expansion. So we're used to the word Hooft expansion in large N gauge theories. But they found that even in SU2 gauge theory, there is a Hooft expansion, which is really striking. So what do I mean by a Hooft expansion? Here, we define these coefficients G to J for arbitrary J. But here, I quoted the answer just for G2. J is like the charge density or the energy density of the state that is created from the vacuum by acting with these operators. So the idea is that let's study the system when J goes to infinity. So we have G and mils, and we have J. And the idea is to try to take the charge of the operator OJ to be very large, to take J to infinity. And what they found is that perturbation theory organizes itself in the following way. So they found that they found it by an explicit computation of the first few terms in perturbation theory. So they found that if you take log 2j and you take j to infinity, perturbation theory organizes itself in a Hooft-like expansion. Namely, there is a series in j to the minus k, which looks like a genus expansion, so j is like n. And then there are some functions k of the Hooft coupling, which is given by g and mil squared times j. It's an extremely non-trivial property of perturbation theory. In the old days, the way Hooft proved that such a reorganization of perturbation theory takes place is by this ribbon graph techniques, the double line notation. Here there are no double lines, it's SU2 gauge theory. So the fact that perturbation theory reorganizes itself in this genus expansion like fashion is really striking. And it might even be true in QCD. People, we don't know. It might be a general fact. And the question is, why? Another progress in this field was done by the work of Hellermann and collaborators. Hellermann and collaborators studied a different limit. They studied the limit of fixed G and mils and large J. Let me just write it down. So this is one limit you could study. Large J with fixed G and mils squared times J. That leads to a Hooft-like expansion, surprisingly. Hellermann and collaborators studied a different limit in which G and mils is fixed.
Sorry, Zahar, can I ask something?
Yes.
So something naive first. Remind me, this function, the function that is the main player of the talk, this G2J, can be computed by localization?
Well, you can write an expression for it. I'll get to it. You can compute it, but you still get something which is pretty hard, at least when J is large.
Okay, but there is a localization expression.
Yes, okay. I'll get to it. That's the main point.
But then another question. So this expression, when you write a sum like this, it's only really meaningful if you have a definition for this FK, right? Otherwise, any series you can write like this.
This one? No, this is extremely non-trivial. The fact that the expansion can be reorganized in such a way is only possible if with each order in Jiang Mill squared, there is a, well, yeah, it's non-trivial as long as k, you know, is k here would run from minus 1 to infinity. And so what is the statement here is extremely non-trivial. It means that if you keep Jiang Mill squared times j fixed, and you take j to be large, the leading order contribution is given by some function of Jiang Mill squared times g, times j. That didn't have to be true. They found it, they did not prove it. They found it by inspection of the first few diagrams. So what they actually did in these two works is to compute the first few terms in the Tooft expansion. And they found that each order of Jiang Mills, let's say n, comes with a series in j, which goes at most, let's say, 2n. To n. So they found that this goes like with a series like this. This is not manifest in the Feynman rules. This is manifest in the final answer. There are cancellations. So it didn't have to be true. And it's really weird that there is a Tooft expansion in SU2 gauge theory. Okay.
F of k is expected to be analytic
at 0? Say again?
F of k is expected
Well, now you can ask lots of questions. You can ask a question, for instance, is the dependence on the Tooft coupling analytic at 0 Tooft coupling? Is there an interesting limit when the Tooft coupling is large? Is there a dual description, right? So yeah, these are the motivations for this work, these kind of questions. Another limit you could study is fix Jiang Mill squared and take j to infinity. This is a limit that Hellermann and collaborators have studied. And they have claimed that in this limit, the physics of these correlation functions is described by a non-relativistic Goldstone boson. So in this limit, there is a non-relativistic Goldstone boson. Okay? They have a physical argument to support this claim. And it would be nice to see if this really comes out of this system, if we can prove this assertion. These two limits are distinct. This limit is much more complicated, or much richer, I should say. It cannot be matched by a single Goldstone boson, for instance. OK, so this is the problem of trying to understand these various limits. And one piece of context that is useful to have in mind is the following. I'm just going to give one more piece of context about the large J limit. This is some, so large J. Is like, so large J is essentially taking heavy light in the language of the bootstrap. So for instance, you can think about it as the OP coefficient of OJ, OJ bar, OJ plus 1 bar, and OJ, O1. So this is the OP coefficient that we're talking about. It's the OP coefficient of some light operator inside some in a heavy state with finite charge density. Okay. And this is, of course, closely related to this eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. In eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, people have made various conjectures based on many body simulations that when you study correlation functions of light operators in heavy states, then they are described by random matrix theory. So there is this a huge literature on the idea that you get some kind of thermal states and random matrix theory if you study such correlation functions. Now, of course, they're talking about generic states. And this is a supersymmetric theory. These are BPS states. They're non-generic. But it should, you should keep this analogy in mind, because as you'll see, we'll be able to derive random matrix theory in this limit. And so this connection seems to be somehow respected, even though these are non-generic states. But this is one piece of context, that the large J limit is like studying correlation functions in a heavy state. And it could be a more general question in the context of the bootstrap of whether random matrix, there are ansatz of random matrix theory solves the bootstrap, and what are the constraints on this random matrix theory. So this will come out soon. This is just a piece of context. OK, now, how do we attack the problem of computing this G2J, Jiang Mill squared? So now let's get to the. Are there any questions about the introduction? OK, so now let's get to the details. So the main point would be that we will find the duality, which would explain why there is a 12th expansion. So we will find the duality to a matrix model in the double scaling limit, which would prove that there is a 12th expansion. And that would allow us to understand the physics in these various limits. So let's see how this comes about. So let's start by seeing what the supersymmetric localization tells us. So what does SUSY localization tell us about the correlation functions of OJ at zero, O bar J at infinity in flat space? Okay. So these correlation functions can be understood to some extent from supersymmetric localization. Supersymmetric localization gives the following weird formula. So there is a weird algorithm or formula that you have to follow in order to extract these correlation functions from a supersymmetric localization. So let me just tell you what the algorithm is. It looks a little bit, it looks unnatural, but it's correct and it can be derived. So what you start from is the following. So there is a function f, which is a function of one variable, a. This is a real variable for the sake of this lecture. So there is one real variable a, and there is g and mils. So there is a function like that, which I'm not going to write in any detail, except that I'll say that it looks approximately, it can be rewritten using, it can be rewritten as minus 1 over g and mils squared a squared times some ratio of a ratio of double Barnes functions. So there's this special function that's going to appear all over the place. It's given by a simple Gaussian piece. And this is the only place where there is a Young-Mills coupling. And then some ratio of Barnes gamma functions, where h of a is defined to be a product of two Barnes gamma functions. Double Barnes, OK. And there is some I here. OK, so there is this special function that's going to appear all over the place. I'm just going to call it f. So supersymmetric localization says the following funny thing about this G to J. So first of all, you have to construct a big, big matrix. Is what?
Even,
yes. This function is even.
H
is even. Oh, yeah. There is probably a typo somewhere. I won't be able to find the typo now in real time. Yeah, there is a. Yeah, it doesn't matter now. You can find the explicit expression for this function in this paper. Now, what the supersymmetric localization formula tells us to do is something a little bit contrived. To extract the G to J, what you have to do is you have to integrate this function, dA. You have to put like a squared here. So you take dA times a squared times this function f of a and g and mils. OK, so you study this integral from minus infinity to plus infinity. And then what you do is you put powers here of a, which are 2k plus L. And this defines a certain coefficient, which we call MKL. This coefficient, in fact, doesn't depend on K and L separately. It only depends on the sum of K and L, obviously. So what you do is you think about it as a matrix. You think about this as entries of some big, big matrix, as entries of some big matrix, infinite matrix. Because of the exponential factor here, this is all completely convergent. So there is no issue with convergence. So you think about it as a big matrix. And now what you do, you write this matrix, and you take the j plus 1 by j plus 1 block. You take the j plus 1 by j plus 1 block. You take the determinant of that block. And then you divide this determinant by the determinant of a slightly smaller block, which is j by j. Okay, so g to j as a function of g and mil squared is given by the determinant of the j plus 1 plus j plus 1 block divided by the determinant of the j plus j block. So that's what supersymmetric localization tells you. Now, of course, you can put it on the computer, and now you can of course do a lot of explicit computations. In particular, you can reproduce the answers from Feynman diagrams, amazingly. And again. Just a second. There is the microphone here.
So this is only the perturbative. It's only the perturbative bit.
You're asking about reproducing perturbation theory?
I'm asking that the fact that you're not including instanton corrections.
Oh, yeah. So here I just gave you the answer for this function f without instanton corrections. So there are instanton corrections here, which are of the order of the usual 1 over g and mil squared. But soon I will explain that these are not important. You might remember that in the literature on the large n limit of Young-Mills theory, it was argued that Tuft instantons are not important. Polyakov Tuft instantons are not important. The same will be true here. It turns out that in this new Tuft limit, gauge instantons are not important. So you get a non-trivial answer from planar diagrams, and you don't have to include instantons. So that's why I'm going to omit these instantons. And I'll justify it at the end, when the physics will be more clear. Any other questions? So using this weird prescription for computing determinants of horrible integrals, you can do a lot of explicit work. You can reproduce perturbation theory. You can reproduce the answers from Feynman diagrams. You can study the questions of Borel resummation. And people have done a lot of great work on that. But I'm not going to review it. I'll just say that people reproduced perturbation theory. People proved Borel resummability. And many other things, which are interesting. But this is not the subject of this talk. The subject of this talk is what do we do about the large A limit? And how do we prove that there is a new Tuft coupling? And the large A limit is complicated, right? I mean, even if you are very powerful and you have a big computer, it might still be an intractable or formidable exercise to compute this huge determinants. So the large A limit needs a new idea. And that's what I wanted to tell you about. And I think that the lessons that we learned are general. First of all, this makes contact with the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. And secondly, I think that this idea that there is a new Tuft coupling might be general. So what do we do about the large A limit? So the idea is the following. The idea is to use a theorem by Andreev. So there is a theorem by Andreev. The theorem by Andreev is a theorem about orthogonal polynomials. And what this theorem allows you to do is to convert some such integrals, determinants of integrals, to a model of random matrices. So these random matrices are going to be emergent. Here, the integrals are all one-dimensional. But now we'll have integrals over random matrices, which are j by j. So the theorem by Andreev allows you to convert the problem to an integral over j by j random matrices. Random matrices. C. So let C be a J by J general complex matrix. This is a general complex matrix. And there is the using this theorem of Andreev, we can rewrite the answer as a passing integral over random matrices, over this such J by J complex matrices. Unlike other random matrix models, where the matrices are Hermitian, here the matrices are complex. But if you are familiar with the C equals 1 matrix model duality, or with the recent work on the SYK model, that might not shock you, because in the context of supersymmetric SYK model, or in the context of the supersymmetric C equals 1 matrix model duality, such matrices were more natural than the Hermitian matrices. So these matrices are kind of more natural when there is supersymmetry, rather than the Hermitian matrices. So what we do? So the theorem of Andreev allows you to, after some work, I'm, of course, skipping all the details. It allows you to rewrite the determinant of the J by J matrix as a pass integral. So there is some J factorial that you need to take out. And then there is a pass integral over general complex matrices, which are J by J. So these matrices are emergent. And there is an emergent gauge symmetry that I'll explain soon. And what is the potential for this space of matrices? Unlike in the general eigenstate thermalization hypothesis and random matrix theory, where we don't know the potential, here the potential is completely fixed by supersymmetric localization. So but the potential is a single trace interaction. It's trace log trace of the logarithm of this function f of C dagger C. So you take the function f that appeared in supersymmetric localization, and instead of applying it to real numbers, we apply it to the matrix C dagger C. Then you take the logarithm of this power series, and you take the single trace. It's a single trace interaction. So that's the answer. And f is the same, very same function that appeared before. Now, this means that there is an emergent gauge symmetry. The emergent gauge symmetry is where you conjugate C by general unitary matrices from left and right. So this is a bifundamental emergent gauge symmetry. U and V are unitary. Unitary J by J matrices, so they're in UJ. Okay? So this relationship is exact. It's hard to prove, but it's exact. And now, taking the large J limit is much more natural, because there is a huge amount of literature about how to deal with pass integrals over random matrices in the large J limit, when the matrices are big. There is the Wigner semi-arc. The distribution of eigenvalues takes a continuous form. And now we can just apply all the tools in the toolbox to understand the large J limit. It looks much more tractable using this approach than using the previous approach. So first of all, using this bifundamental gauge symmetry, you can diagonalize any matrix. Any general complex matrix can be diagonalized by acting with different unitary matrices from left and right. So we can always diagonalize it. And the fun thing is that unlike in Hermitian matrices, where the eigenvalues are arbitrary real numbers, when you diagonalize general complex matrices using this procedure, the eigenvalues can be taken to be positive or non-negative without loss of generality. Because using V, you can always rotate the phases away and put all the eigenvalues to be strictly non-negative. So we can also rewrite this integral more explicitly as an integral over non-negative real numbers. So we can rewrite this integral as a product of integrals dxi over non-negative, now this goes from 0 to infinity, and there is some potential for these eigenvalues. So we just get a sum over, because this is a single trace interaction, you just get a sum over some functions of the eigenvalues. And there is a van der Monden determinant, as usual. So the eigenvalues are not independent. They are, of course, interacting through the usual van der Monde determinant, where delta is a product of xi minus xj over I smaller than j. OK? So you get a product of, you get a bunch of eigenvalues that sit in some potential, and they interact through the repulsion of the van der Monde determinant that comes from the change of variables from the general matrices to the diagonal matrices. OK? And OK, this class of problems is very well studied. OK, so now let me now explain why this proves that there is a double scaling limit. So I'll do now two things. Using this approach, we can immediately remark on the previous surprising Tuft expansion, because now the Tuft expansion boils down to ribbon graphs or double line notation. So the existence of a Tuft expansion now is more clear. So let's try to understand the physics of the Tuft limit from this approach. So as you remember, I emphasized that this function f has a Gaussian. So this f was the log, so I should put log. So yes, so when you diagonalize, you have to take some square roots. And I'm extremely impressionistic here. It's actually f of square root of x, and there are no squares here. That's what it turns out at the end. There are many small steps that I'm skipping. So log of f of xi, from what we said before, there were two pieces. There was this Gaussian piece, and then there were these ratios of Barnes double gamma functions. So therefore, this looks like xi. I'll put a minus sign here. Oh, so this looks like xi over g and mu squared plus this correction due to the Barnes gamma functions. So let's just write it as Barnes. This doesn't have g and mu squared. Now, it's now clear why it's a natural limit to take, where g and mu squared times j is fixed. Because we are used, we know that this class of matrix models have a nice large n limit. This is what we learned from Tuft, right? Any such matrix model where this is a single trace interaction would have a nice Tuft expansion. That's what we learn in QFT1 or QFT2. I don't know. So this class of matrix model has a nice Tuft expansion. So now it's clear that if only this prefactor here behaved like n, where n is the size of the matrix, or j, sorry, j is the size of the matrix, we would be in good shape. So indeed, we want 1 over g and mu squared to behave like j, physically. And then if we were to drop these Barnes pieces, this would be a perfectly nice matrix integral where there is a nice Tuft expansion. So we can rewrite the answer for our matrix model for this guy as dc pass integral over the matrices with square root of c dagger c, and then there is a the Tuft coupling lambda, and then j. So we have j over the Tuft coupling lambda. That's the first piece. And then there is a correction, which is a certain single trace interaction due to the Barnes. This is enough to prove that there is a double scaling limit, which is a very non-trivial fact from the perturbation theory point of view. Because we're talking about a single trace deformation of a model that has a large n expansion. And it's known that single trace correlation functions have a nice Tuft expansion. And therefore, when you add a single trace deformation, which is down by a factor of n compared to this, this would have a nice Tuft expansion just from Tuft's diagrammatic. So we understand why this Tuft coupling, lambda, is a natural object. This is point number one, remark number one. Remark number two is that we can understand the emergence of the non-relativistic Goldstone boson. That's a different limit. So let me know, are there any questions about remark number one? Remark number one is supposed to prove, essentially in one line, after this rewriting of the, after this dual description, in the dual description, the large n limit is manifest. That's what I'm trying to say. While it's not manifest in the gauge theory description, in this description, it's totally manifest. Remark number two concerns with the Hellermann-like limit. So another limit you could study is where this is fixed, and j goes to infinity. This limit is the limit that was studied by Hellermann and collaborators, where you keep the coupling fixed, but you take the charge density. You take the charge to be large, and therefore the charge density to be fixed. So in this limit, the matrix model also simplifies, but in a different way. So when you have the physics of this limit is the following from the matrix model point of view. When you have j by j matrices, and these matrices are random, the typical eigenvalue is very large. So if you were to simulate random matrices on the computer, the typical eigenvalue is large. So the typical eigenvalue in this ensemble scales like j, linearly in j. And therefore, this is only true in this limit. This is not true in the double scaling limit. Double scaling limit, you have to resum all the planar diagrams. But in this limit, it's true that the typical eigenvalue is very large. So since the typical eigenvalue is very large, you can in fact neglect these complicated Barnes double gamma functions interactions because they all decay at large eigenvalues. So it's a small exercise to do to check that from these ratios of Barnes gamma functions, if you go to large eigenvalues, there is nothing that remains, except for the logarithmic correction that's important. But since I'm not explaining the details, I'm going to just neglect it. So the physics in this limit is that the Barnes goes away. You don't need the Barnes gamma functions, except for some small residual piece. And the matrix model simplifies dramatically. Right. I'll make this comment now. So she is asking about the gauge instanton corrections. So the fantastic thing about this limit, like in the Tooft limit, is that the gauge instantons are negligible, because they behave like this. Right? And if you go to the fixed Tooft coupling limit, this goes like e to the minus j over lambda. So if you are interested in capturing the power series to all orders in n and the Tooft expansion exactly, you can neglect gauge instantons.
Yeah, but I'm asking about this. Yeah,
right. Yes. In this limit, this is an open question. In this limit, the instantons are important. A priori, we don't know why not. But if you the numerical bootstraps shows that to reproduce the predictions of the non-relativistic Goldstone boson, you don't need to consider them. It's an open problem. We don't understand why. Also here, there are exponentially small corrections in J, which we cannot compute unless we take those into account. But to all orders in the Tooft coupling, that's enough. So here, there is an open problem about the gauge instantons, which are not a priori suppressed. OK, so in this limit, the matrix model simplifies dramatically because the typical eigenvalues are very large. So all that you need to carry is 1 over g young mu squared, c degree c with a square root. And then there is a logarithm, a trace of logarithm of c degree c. There is a trace here too. So you can prove that since the typical eigenvalues are very large in this limit, all you need is this matrix model. And amazingly, this matrix model is exactly solvable. This matrix model was studied by mathematicians, Wischalt and Laguerre. It's actually related to Laguerre polynomials. And it was also studied by people who did the equals one matrix model duality. And it goes under the name of Altland-Zirnbauer. So this matrix model appeared in the context of summing over random super Riemann surfaces. It appeared in QCD by Verberschott and others. So this matrix model is very familiar. It appeared in many other contexts, which are closely related to the context that we're studying, but we don't understand the exact relationship. And in any case, when you solve this matrix model, you get some answers as a function of G and Mills and as a function of the size of the matrix J. And this matrix model is exactly solvable. And amazingly, the partition functions of this matrix model exactly coincide with a non-relativistic Goldstone boson. So this matrix model is dual to a non-relativistic Goldstone boson. We don't have a fundamental understanding of that, but you just compute. The non-relativistic Goldstone boson is the almost free system that you can second quantize and compute. This is a solvable system that appeared in some previous works. You solve both of them, they give the exact same answers. So this kind of proves, or you may have said that you don't need to prove it, but it proves Hellermann's et al.'s ansatz for this limit, that the physics is described by a non-relativistic Goldstone boson. This is not the case for the Tuft limit. The Tuft limit is richer, and I'll talk about it now. Yes? Balt is asking about S-duality. This question is the same as about the large N limit. When you take the Tuft limit, S-duality is gone. Similarly, when we take this limit, S-duality is gone. So it has extremely similar properties to the usual Tuft limit. In this limit, the S-duality should remain. But it would not be very wise to neglect the gauge instantons. So when people do it numerically, they take G and Mills square to be some fixed small number and take J to be large. And people just assume that the gauge instantons are not important, though there is no proof. And it seems true numerically. Yes, then you're out of your water. Yes, typically in numerical bootstrap, they put like 0.01, run the computer, and hope for the best. And it seems to work. It seems that the instantons are not enhanced in this limit for some reason. We cannot prove it, but we cannot prove it. But the fact of the matter is, if you neglect gauge instantons, you do this duality to the random matrix model, it exactly reproduces the non-relativistic Goldstone boson. I mean, so this is a very weird duality between a second quantized, second Goldstone boson and a random matrix model. If you studied ever the literature on the QCD, there is a similar story there, that the pion Lagrangian is dual to a certain matrix model, which is actually very similar to that. So it seems like a version of that story. Yeah. Yeah, so in this is a great question. You see that you can just remove G and Mills here because this can eat the G and Mills. Then it will come out of here and it will be just a multiplicative factor. And also in the non-relativistic Goldstone boson theory, the predictions don't depend essentially on G and Mills. So you get a non-trivial power series in 1 over J, but there is no dependence on G and Mills. This is unlike the double scaling limit where there is an extremely non-trivial dependence on the Tuft coupling. It respects S-duality in an empty way. Yes. But it's not a priori justified to do these manipulations at large angles. Yes. Yes. Now I'll talk about it. This non-relativistic effective field theory has a... Of course, you cannot compute everything in life with effective field theory. There are non-perturbative corrections due to massive particles that you've integrated out. So there are exponentially small pieces that would be really interesting to compute because there is numerical work on the bootstrap that you could match this to. And I'll explain those in the last 5 minutes. We computed them using the random matrix model approach. So we now have an exact result for these exponentially small corrections. this is not an exponentially small correction. This comes out of the random matrix model immediately. Yes. This is something that appears in the analytic expansion in 1 over J. Here I was talking about exponentially small corrections in J. All the analytic pieces come out of the random matrix model automatically. Any other questions? OK. So let me just now make a few comments about the Tuft limit. In the Tuft limit, I'll just erase and make some comments about the Tuft limit. The dual description in the Tuft limit is a little bit more complicated than the non-relativistic Goldstone boson. And we have a proposal for it. So if you consider these correlation functions in the Tuft limit, what you find to the first two non-trivial orders is something that's linear in J. Sorry, I have to take the logarithm of G to J. So you find something that's linear in J, where the dependence on the Tuft coupling is known, and it's boring. It's just log of the Tuft coupling. This is exact. This is boring. However, the next order, which is J to the power 0, there is a non-trivial function of the Tuft coupling. And then there are corrections which are down by J, and so on. What I want to tell you about it is a little bit about this. This non-trivial function of the Tuft coupling, the first non-trivial function of the Tuft coupling. So in this heroic work by Baccaria and Bourget, they computed the first few terms in this function of F lambda by perturbation theory. It's like you do perturbation theory in super young, n equals 4 super young mills at large n. In the Tuft coupling, you can do perturbation theory in this limit, in the Tuft coupling. And they found some numbers. So they went up to lambda squared. There was some number lambda cubed. And they conjectured, based on this, that there is a good double scaling limit. So using the matrix model technique, it's possible to give an exact answer for f of lambda, an exact closed form answer, which I'm just going to quote now and tell you one little corollary of that exact answer. So using the random matrix model technique, you can write that f of lambda is given by an integral from 0 to 4 of some function, which is called the Marchenko-Pastor function, against this single trace perturbation of the Barnes double functions. So this is the log of Barnes. This is a very schematic formula, obviously, but I'll explain the ingredients. This is the density of eigenvalues in this ensemble of chiral matrices. This is just the density of eigenvalues, and it's a function that looks like this. It's cut off at 4, and it starts at 0. It's some known function, which looks like 4 over x minus 1. No, x over 4 minus 1. Something like that. I'll just fix it and write it as 1 minus x over 4 so that it makes sense. So it's a known function, which has to do with the density of eigenvalues for these chiral matrices. And this is the single trace perturbation. This is the single trace perturbation that we had with the Barn gamma functions. So the idea of this formula is simply that to obtain the function of the Tuft coupling, all we got to do is we have a solvable model, which is this chiral matrix model with the single trace interaction. And there is a complicated trace log Barnes that appears, and we just lower it in perturbation theory, and that's it. So this is like the first non-trivial order in the expansion in the interaction between the potential for the eigenvalues. So you just lower the interaction from the exponent, you integrate against the density of eigenvalues in the model without this interaction, and that's it. So this is like first order in perturbation theory in the Tuft expansion. And it turns out that this integral exactly reproduces what was previously computed explicitly. And it gives you a closed form formula for all lambda. On the right-hand side of the integral, lambda appears here. I suppressed it for some no good reason. Yeah, it's the endpoint of the Marchenko-Pastor distribution of eigenvalues. Yeah. So this is an integral that you can solve. And it produces this answer. One interesting limit is lambda going to infinity, which is the strongest Tuft coupling limit. This is a lot like BMN, if you're familiar with BMN. So in the strongest Tuft coupling limit, this f of lambda approaches e to the minus square root of lambda 4 pi. And perhaps This is what you refer to as the, so it's exponentially small, and there is a square root of lambda, looking a lot like a string world sheet, instanton type of thing. And it's quite tantalizing. So we're trying to understand it from some semi-classical dual description. It looks very much like in BMN. But in any event, this exponentially small correction at strong at Hooft coupling exactly matches the numerical work on what I mentioned before, the corrections to the effective field theory of the non-relativistic Goldstone boson. So this matches essentially the conjectures for the corrections to the effective to the corrections to the non-relativistic Goldstone boson. But I'm not going to explain it in much detail. I ran out of time. But two things to say about it. One is that it looks a lot like in what you see in BMN, which is tantalizing. Secondly, it looks like it should be obtainable from some classical dual theory. And thirdly, this matches a lot of numerical work on corrections to the non-relativistic Nambu-Goldstone boson. So yeah, and that's the last thing I wanted to say. Good.
Is f of lambda analytic away from infinity?
We found by studying this integral, we found that the expansion in lambda has a finite radius of convergence, as you expect from the Tuft expansion in BMN or in large n gauge theories. And so we believe that the answer is yes. We believe that this expansion is convergent in lambda.
Yeah, I was just asking whether radius convergence is infinite or there's some singularity, some finite.
I don't know yet. I don't know yet. Yeah.
So, can you derive this new matrix model directly from the starting point of localization?
That's a fantastic question. I have a student who is thinking about it, trying to derive this matrix model directly. That might be a useful thing to do, because if the connection to non-supersymmetric gauge theories is, if there is such a connection, it might be an inspiring way to start.
So let me just make a...
Instead of doing Coulomb branch localization, you might want to try to do something else that would spit out the random matrix. I mean, this J by J random matrix model looks emergent, but it's physically very motivated, because there is a J is the charge of the state. So it's made of J quanta. So these J by J matrices seem to describe the J quanta of which the state is made.
So let me just make a question slash comment. So you start with probably, but tell me if it's correct. In localization, you start with a matrix model, which is 2x2 because you have SU2.
Yes.
But you have N operators because you are K operators, whatever, right? The number of operators that you started with, I guess, in your correlation function of K operators.
Or you can do a two-point function of very heavy operators. It's
okay, or just two-point function, yeah.
Two-point functions of heavy operators.
I'm just saying, in some matrix models, sometimes there are dualities that relate K-point functions in N by N gauge theory with N-point functions in K by K.
Right. No, this
and
is not like this.
And it sounds very familiar
yeah,
here.
Yeah, it does, but here we're studying a two-point function of very heavy operators. And it's just, sorry, yeah, two-point function of very heavy operators. And you can write it using 2x2 matrices, the SU2 matrices.
Yes.
But then you have to take these determinants, huge determinants of various integrals, which are 2x2 each.
But that's already a technical detail on how to compute the matrix model, the 2x2 matrix model, right? You are going to the determinants is already a way of solving the matrix model. I'm saying that there are dualities between matrix models that change the rank of the matrix model and the number of operators.
Right.
And I suspect that you can write your starting point in a way that using those dualities, you go directly to a J by J matrix model.
Right. But
and then it would be a way of deriving it directly without going through all these theorems of orthogonal polynomials and so on.
You might be right. There might be such a thing. I don't know. The way the subject evolved historically is that Peston first computed the expectation value of 1, but on the sphere, not in flat space. In flat space makes no sense. He computed the one on the sphere. And one on the sphere was given by a 2x2 integral, an integral over two variables. Then the question was how to compute non-trivial correlation functions. And that turned out to involve taking ratios of determinants of the same integrand, of the same kind of integral that Peston encountered. And then at large J, this became intractable, and so there is the matrix model description. But there might be a more direct route, I agree. I just don't know.
Yeah, I never thought about this, but given that these dualities exist that change the rank to the number of the, right, you have a k-point function of n by n goes to n-point function of k by k, and if, say, the right-hand side, we have an obvious Tuft limit, and then on the left-hand side, it's not so obvious.
Yes.
But I mean, given that in those cases everything is very explicit, it must be possible from there to understand directly why on the left-hand side there's also a Tuft limit. In other words, why for you, from the beginning, you would have directly a Tuft limit.
You might be right. I just don't, yeah, I don't have anything to say.
Since I have the mic, let me ask you a question. So, in this effective field theory of at large charge density of Hellermann et al, you have, I mean, as is an effective field theory, so you have higher derivative terms with coefficients that you don't know how to compute. So in this case, can you compute all these coefficients since
yes.
you have the microphone?
In this case, the coefficients that are not computable in that story can be derived from the log of the Barnes. So there is a systematic, so in that limit, as I mentioned, the intuition is that the large eigenvalues are pretty large. And the Barnes functions are not important in that limit. But if you want to capture more and more sophisticated corrections, you need to take the tails of the Barnes double gamma functions. And they have some coefficients. And those coefficients capture those coefficients that are not a priori known in effective field theory.
But then, I mean, these coefficients do depend on G Yang Mills.
No, it turns out that to all orders in the 1 over J expansion, it completely drops out. This is a fact about the fixed G Yang Mills large J limit, that you might think that G Yang Mills would enter into higher orders in 1 over J, and in fact, we were confused for many weeks about why it drops out. But you do the analysis, and you can eventually prove that it drops out to all orders. It's a very non-trivial fact. And if you just think about it like mentally, that you expand this function, you would pick up factors of G Yang Mills, it turns out it's not true. There are cancellations. In fact, if there was any dependence on G Yang Mills, it would have contradicted the picture of effective field theory of a Goldstone boson. So it's an extremely surprising consistency check. You can prove that all the F terms, all the higher operators in the Goldstone boson theory cannot depend on G Yang Mills from supersymmetry. So yeah, if this check would have failed, then it would be a disaster.
Perhaps a related question. So, I mean, in the effective description, we expect the mass of the first, so say, gapped mode or charge to depend on the coupling normally. Like if I normally, like in our weakly coupled system, the mass would go like something like G squared J. But here you're saying is that the expansion of Hellermann is independent of G squared.
Yes.
So could you motivate a bit more why from the EFT point of view?
The question is why from the non-relativistic Goldstone boson point of view, G Yang Mills drops, or why does
yes.
it drop from this point of view?
Not from this point of view, I understand. Say from the Hellermann
okay.
point of view would be the explanation.
Okay. From the point of view of an effective field theory of a Goldstone boson, the reason that G Yang Mills drops out is the following. There is a Goldstone boson, phi, and it has a kinetic term, okay? And then it has a four-derivative interaction, which is d phi to the four. And then there are higher interactions. Now, this may depend on G Yang Mills, but you can remove it. You can remove the dependence on G Yang Mills because it's just the kinetic term, so you can canonically normalize it. And this guy, you can prove using some conformal anomaly techniques that this depends on some anomalies and cannot depend on the point on the conformal manifold. Okay? And then you have to worry about the higher terms. And it turns out that the higher terms depend on what's called the graviphoton in the supergravity literature. And once you go to flat space, they drop out. So therefore, the only two terms in the effective theory cannot depend on G Yang Mills. And therefore, to all orders in 1 over J, there is no G Yang Mills dependence.
Zora, I would like to understand better why you said it was striking that this function G to J admitted for large J that asymptotic expansion. So namely, let me say...
I just didn't understand the question.
So why at the beginning you were saying that this G to J function was found by this, some authors that admitted for large J, the asymptotic, this expansion 1 over J, and then times the Toft coupling G squared times J. So, namely, what I want to say is that if you have a two-point function, two heavy operators, typically you expect that the perturbative parameter is no longer your original coupling constant, but it becomes essentially a Toft, even if you don't have a large N. So, for instance, if you compute a two-point function in 4 minus epsilon expansion of a very charged operator, phi to the k, phi to the q, where q is large, then you get in perturbation theory, you realize that the expansion parameter is no longer epsilon, but it's epsilon times q.
Right.
So looks like effectively what you would expect, right?
Yes, I very much believe that this phenomenon that they discovered extends beyond supersymmetry.
Indeed.
And indeed, it's true in the epsilon expansion, and it also seems true to the first few orders in real life QCD. But here, the advantage is that we can prove it to all orders. And I've never seen a proof to all orders in the other cases. But since we don't have a double line notation, it's not clear how to prove these theorems yet. Here, the duality with the random matrix allows you to immediately prove it, sort of, immediately in quotation marks. But yeah, I very much believe that these ideas might extend beyond supersymmetry. But it remains to be seen. I didn't understand the question. Yeah, I mean, there are natural questions of this sort to ask, but yeah, I don't have much to say at the moment.
I was just wondering if something of this survives if you go to, say, the higher rank SUN theory.
Excellent question. The higher, you heard the question, so yeah, I don't know. But the intuition that there are J quanta that make up heavy states and that you should be able to describe the answers by, you know, random matrices which are J by J, this intuition, I believe, is very robust. Something like this must be true. And this Andreev theorem that allowed us to rewrite it in terms of the matrix model still holds. It seems good. So I very much believe that at least in the fixed coupling large J limit, the matrix model techniques would be useful. Whether there is a Toft expansion for SU3 gauge theory, I don't know. Nobody checked this. Okay. Thanks very much.